represent all the time. And then after maybe that lasts a year or two or something, and then after years two and three, you're like, yeah, does it fit? Is it a smell? I'll stick it on if it fits and it doesn't smell. That'll do. And you've got loads on. I've still got workshop stuff, you know, things that I've been in. There's literally a clothing store in my home that I can't move these items. So yeah, I guess part of the founder's experience. Anyway, folks, we are live, everybody. So welcome to Founders Focus. This is the thing that I enjoy doing the most. And I can say that absolutely honestly. I'm really thrilled to be speaking with people that have been so annoyed about the problems in recruiting that they've gone ahead and trying to set up a business to try and solve that. We're up to episode 25 already. I've had some wonderful conversations with inspirational people, different personalities coming from different backgrounds, all telling us their founder stories and also what they've learned in their entrepreneurial journey, what they've learned as a business leader and as a runner of organizations. So I hope you're going to continue and enjoy this show with us. And today we have my good friend, a longtime contact. It's Alex Van Claveren, CEO of Candidate. So Alex, welcome to the show, man.
Super to be on, hun. Super to be on.
Great to have you, sir. And obviously you and I kind of, rewind. It was at least 4 or 5 years, maybe even longer ago, right at the beginning points when you were starting the business, I think. So can you give us a bit of an origin story as to how, you know, the idea of Candidate emerged in your mind? You thought, you know what, I think I need to build a business to solve these problems I'm encountering.
Yeah, so we met 6.5 years ago. I actually checked.
You know exactly.
This. It was summer 6 years ago, basically. So for this particular business, I was working at a company called One Fine Stay. I was the GM there. When I joined, there were approximately 100, 150 people. They'd raised their Series B, something like that. They then raised their Series C. So they went from 150 up to 350 in a pretty short space of time. Just so happened, I sat next to the, it was their talent team. And what they'd done really impressively at kind of One Fine Stay is the founder network had attracted the most unbelievable team for the first, I would say, 100. But then trying to expand past that 100 up to 350 was a real challenge. We had a retention issue, which is something that all startups, all scale-ups face. And it was just watching that challenge sort of close up, watching all the different sort of challenges of the process, everyone interviewing in different ways. So remember, this was 7 years ago. So I think talent acquisition has come on significantly since that, or the knowledge base of it. So it was just watching that, I realized that once founders actually raise their Series A, the biggest challenge is on the hiring side. That becomes their biggest problem. And now we know that basically 80% of all funding actually goes on hiring or for people. So I think it was just seeing that up close. I just thought there must be a way to help founders in this painful part of the process.
You know what? That's really fascinating. There's two things that I think you've introduced, Alex, that are really fascinating. And we'll maybe sit on both of them in turn. Firstly, you came from a business background. So you don't come from recruiting, but you were a GM at this startup. And obviously you're a hiring manager effectively, which I think is quite a rare beast for a hiring manager to come in and actually, you know, understand that hiring is such a significant problem to set up a recruiting business. But also, I think you have a very clear view as to the problem set, in the sense that it's after the founders have run out of friends, basically. When they've run out of people that they know already, that's when the recruiting challenges really come into play. And that's when you need to have a strategy. And I think a lot of founders maybe don't understand that until they've gone through the gone round the blocks a little bit, because they think, hey, I can recruit all these great people. And it's like, yes, of course you can, because they're ex-colleagues of yours, or they're mates from university, or whatever it is that you already have this, you know, pre-built relationship with. The challenge in recruiting is when you hire people you don't know. Like, you don't know this person. How do you actually make sure that's the right person? So two of those things in turn. Let's talk about your career history up until the point where you decided I want to do recruiting. So tell me how you got to being, I think, the GM, I think, of One Fine Day, or some sort of role where you were doing a managerial role, right? What was the journey going forward?
The funny thing is that's actually officially my first ever job as an employee. So I had been a founder since the age of 19. I started my first business when I was at uni. I'll give you the short version. We rented a double-decker bus and we used to take people on a piss up, three clubs and onto a bar. We started this in Edinburgh. I left uni.
I didn't know this story,
but I left uni and I was seeing all my friends doing, I don't know, the corporate route or some other sort of grad schemes. And I was like, that's not for me. So I walked into Lloyd's TSB with a business plan. They told me to fuck off. And because they said you're 22, I walked into the Prince's Trust and they were the first people who would actually lend me money. And once I got some money from the Prince's Trust, that's not a grant, that's a loan they give you, and you have to pay that back. But with that, I went into Lloyd's TSB and they said, fair enough, we will match it. So we started that business. We got up to, I think, 18 double-decker buses in 5 cities. That was how I cut my teeth.
What
the lesson there is, never work in a business where, I mean, it involves moving objects and lots of alcohol.
There's more stories to come there. By the way, do we not agree, folks, that this business needs to be revived in the post-COVID era? Like, we need to bring this back.
It's still running. It's been going for 20-something years. I sold it.
Wow.
And here's the big irony is I nearly got hit by one of the buses about 4 years ago. God. And, the headline writes itself, where I was walking across the road. I nearly got hit by a bus. I looked behind, and it was one of my buses.
Right, what's the name of this business? I'm gonna definitely sign up to do this.
It's called Club Class Bus. You can check it out. Please do not judge me on anything that you see on the social media. I'm well out of that and have been for over 15 years. But it is very popular in the stag and hen market, let's say.
I was going to say, there's your clear market. I mean, it's very narrow, right? It's UK, it's clearly UK island type product of thing.
Market fit was definitely...
That's product market fit right there. And also, student town, stick it into a big a city that has young people that are prepared to go out and get blasted, I guess. And there you go. And well, how do you do it? You sell it per bus? I guess you must sell sell per journey. How did it work?
It was basically a tour. Either you did the bar tour or you did the meal, bar and the club tour. So that's how we used to sell it. But it was bizarre because actually it was, obviously that was my first experience of sort of entrepreneurial endeavor. I think I was young entrepreneur of the Lothians, sponsored by Shell Livewire when I was 21. So I thought I was hot stuff. Then about 20, age 25, 26, that's when I went to the States, and that's where I guess I started to understand more about how to raise from kind of VCs. Started my first business out there. It was a platform for brides to plan their weddings. It was called Our Wedding Day. And we actually successfully sold that to two private equity firms, TPG and Leonard Green. The danger there was that I'd sold the business by the time I was 27. Started my second, so I really thought I had it all going on. That is the start of the danger period where you become delusional about your talents possibly and what's possible.
Wow, really, really interesting. Alex, I actually don't forgive myself for not actually knowing this background.
It's pretty quiet.
No, I think it's fascinating. So a couple of things here. Firstly, did you know that you always were going to do your own business? It looked like there was a moment when you're looking at your mates going down the corporate route that it might have crossed your mind to think, right, let's get 4 years in at McKinsey or something, or, do that classic thing. Was that ever on the cards? That was...
Without wanting to sound dramatic, for me there was no other option. I mean, age 19, I just had these ideas and I wanted to try them out. And I don't think that's really ever left me, which is why they all, the one lesson is sometimes just because you have an idea, it doesn't mean you should do it. is definitely what I've found. But it just comes very easily to me, and I enjoy the process and enjoy taking the risk, basically.
Yep, that's fascinating. That's fascinating. Do you think this is something you were born with, Alex, or do you believe that you might have acquired the taste for it along the way? Because a lot of people want to start businesses. A lot of people think, yep, we're going to do it. Most people don't. And I just wonder, you know, is it something inherent, or is it something that's, you know, you can cultivate?
I meet so many different types of entrepreneurs. I think there was always, when I was kind of 19, 20, I guess that was kind of Richard Branson was the, you know, he was the model of the sort of serial entrepreneur. The reality is that you meet a lot of CEOs and founders now, and they come from all different walks of life. Their backgrounds, some have come from consultancy. Certainly, I think for some of the VC-backed businesses, I feel like they have slightly moved away from, let's just call it, the impulsive serial entrepreneur, and they are going for more of the operators. I'm not saying that's right or wrong. It's just that probably they're looking for operators because they're giving them lots of money and they want them to operate a business in a less of an impulsive way. The reality is there are so many different ways that you can run a business. I think what's interesting to me, actually, we've got one client at the moment that they started with actually 8 founders. In fact, we've got 2. So one started with 8, one started with 7. And I think that is the new model, where you really raise money later and you have a much bigger founding team. Why? Because it's too damn difficult as one or two people. It's interesting, on both of these companies, their second time, so they all met at a company, saw each other in action, and now have gone and started their own. And I wonder if this will be a new style of sort of building companies.
That's really interesting. So obviously everyone accepts a dilution, or not even a dilution, but a smaller slice of a potentially larger pie. But the risk is also diffused across the group, because you're doing it in a collegiate way rather than, you know, one person or even 2-3 people like shouldering everything going forward, which it takes different types of people to succeed in those different in those environments, doesn't it? So really interesting to, and I love, by the way, your characterization of the different styles of entrepreneur, and the impulsive entrepreneur versus the operator entrepreneur. Again, different types of people, aren't they? So impulsive, I guess you would describe yourself in this way. What are the strengths that you bring to bear as the CEO? I mean, if you could kind of do a top trumps to say, look, here are my core strengths as a CEO, as a leader, what would they be, Alex?
So just to touch back on one point there, I just want to finish that point of the different types of entrepreneurs. There was one piece of research that was trying to find similarities across all different types of entrepreneurs. And they found that one thing they had in common is they had some sort of petty crime in their teenage years.
Prepare to break the rules. Crime.
Yeah, the rule breaking and that type of thing. Sorry, the question was, what do I bring as a CEO?
Yeah, your own kind of, you must have had moments where you've reflected upon yourself, and or even situations where you've repeated, you know, you've encountered similar situations through different businesses and different roles. And you thought, you know what, I kind of do this quite well. What are the areas of strength would you say you had?
Strengths and weaknesses, for sure. I think, look, definitely bringing the energy, bringing the vision, trying to bring great people into the business, without a doubt. So I've had 2 exits. I've had 2 failures. The failure is very painful. You tend to overanalyze on your failures, and you tend to just, on the successes, you tend to go, oh, well, that was great, and the rest of it. But without doubt, those key people that you meet in, especially when you're at like 30 to 100 people, I think is the most significant phase. We could call that's typically late series A, series B. That, I think, is the most formative phase, success or failure. I'm not necessarily talking about just raising money. Raising money is a good scorecard. I'm just actually that core team, if you can get that core team right, some way you will get to where you want to, or you'll find a route there. So I think those are the two aspects. You know, just energy is, you know, you've got to be up for it. It's my fifth business now. It takes its toll, as you can see. But you've got to come. It's got to feel exciting.
Yeah, and you can't fake that, right? Like you can't fake enthusiasm, like day in, day out, especially as a CEO. I think that is corrosive as an employee to fake enthusiasm, but as a CEO to go ahead and do that, I think it's you can't do it. It's literally you can't.
I mean, you can do it for a while. I think, you know, but I think people who know you well realize, you know, you're not quite as animated as you normally are. Like, there has to be some enjoyment, which is more than making money or anything like that. There has to be something that really excites you. And I think for me, it's probably seeing the team actually develop. So we created this academy. We launched it last summer, and actually seeing people go through the academy and seeing people, it doesn't matter what stage they're joining the business, them actually coming back, and then you meet them 6 months later and you're looking at them thinking, wow, there's something, you know, they've got a spark, or there's something really exciting, or they feel excited about the business. And I think the academy is one of the things that brings me a lot of pleasure, just to see people develop.
That's a really, really interesting insight, Alex. So one of the ways in which a leader might be able to maintain enthusiasm is to actively cultivate the growth of the people that you've hired. You know, create a system where people can experience this growth. Their enthusiasm will just basically osmotically spread throughout the rest of the company, won't it? I mean, I read some research, I think it might have been yesterday, to say that one of the primary drivers behind people looking at job opportunities is the opportunity for career and personal growth. This is now explicitly recognized and stated as one of the things that people are looking for. So if you can actually show something like an academy, like a clear formal commitment to do this, then I think that's going to be like a great way to increase the hiring quality of the people you're bringing in, and kind of even like the retention's got to be better as well, because people are forming their skills.
That's a major reason why we do it. But I think the one reason why I speak to a lot of people who, obviously, in this line of work, you speak to a lot of people who are leaving. And it's always amazing to me, because they're leaving fantastic companies, raise lots of money. And you talk to them and you say, well, it sounds great. What's actually missing here? And for me, it's often what's missing is clarity. Is they're not told, look, if you stay at the business in 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, these are the types of opportunity. So then I think they get blindsided by an opportunity that is just a bit shinier. And for me, you know, and it sounds counterintuitive, but often I'm thinking, no, you should really stay at that company. That's a fantastic company. But, you know, they see something which is a bit shinier. And it's clarity. Having that reassurance of where you can get to at this time, I think it just brings a lot of peace to people.
It's clarity and confidence that path that's been designed will actually come to fruition, isn't it? Because folks, people get their heads turned. You know, talent is being hunted out. If you are in any kind of business doing any kind of like skilled job, guess what? You're getting recruited, and it does. It's not hard to simply open an email instead of ignoring it as usual, just to reply, say, sure, send me something. And then before you know it, you're at third stage interview with another business, and an offer comes in, it's bigger than what you've got currently. Yeah, you might go. So I think you're absolutely right. We need to do a better job of career pathing, don't we? To say, and this is particularly problematic, I think, in the recruiting sector, because we've always, in the different ways in which we've had recruiting sort of organizations form, none of it's clear. You know, if you're in an agency, it's like, there's your desk, do your job, and you know, you get more money if you do well. Maybe you get some extra titling or whatever as you grow up. Not really pathed out. How about internal recruiting? Very similar. It's like, right, join in as a talent partner or whatever. Yeah, maybe there's a path here, but has that been absolutely detailed in terms of how to get there, what the stages are? and indeed what the options might be, because we can see diversification of the potential roles in TA, where maybe it isn't just always straight the team leader and departmental head and all that type of stuff. Maybe you could be an experienced, individual contributor in some way. Perhaps you can be a sourcing specialist, maybe a recruitment marketing specialist, data analyst type person, candidate experience person, wherever it could be. There's like, I can see the diversification of the functions start spiraling out. And for your kind of business, the embedded recruiter type of model, Alex, again, it's like prior to, I guess, your thinking about it, like how does that exactly translate into career opportunity? As an RPO or embedded recruiter, am I just not moving from site to site? Am I just, maybe working bigger accounts? I don't know. So how what goes into the academy? What are you teaching recruiters in order for them to escalate their careers?
So I mean, simple terms, you start as a sourcer. You would then actually work internally. So for one of the talent partners, then you would move to what we call the embedded sourcing model, where you would work directly with a client. So we're a little bit different in that you can actually take one of our sources. Sourcing for me, that was the first thing. And as you said, I didn't come from recruitment. So when I came in, I had to self-teach myself. Sourcing was the first thing that I identified where you can really have an impact. For me, I think from a sales point of view, if you have a great pipeline, you will close deals. I just applied the same type of thinking into sourcing. So we have 42 people in our sourcing team. We bring in fantastic coaches. So I think you know quite a few of them. So Vanessa Rath, Alla Pavlova.
Great.
These are fantastic people at the top of the game, but they all come with a slightly different approach. One of the things I love is they're always trying to source without using LinkedIn. Probably like a lot of people in the industry, LinkedIn is a necessary evil, but I think, and it's, I shouldn't say evil, but it'd be nice to find another way where it's an alternative. So you go to sourcing, then you become a talent coordinator, essentially a junior to mid-level recruiter. Then you become a talent partner. At talent partner, it's typically 3 to 9 month engagement, senior talent partner. Then you become a client delivery manager or a head of client delivery, where you are managing up to 10 talent partners. So there's lots of different opportunities. It doesn't have to be that route. I'm just describing the type of route. I think what's amazing with our team, so we're from 26 countries. We just hired someone in Azerbaijan last week. And I don't think this is, it's not a mystery, but it's amazing where you find talent in the world. And if you're open to it, we've got 16 people in Skopje, Moldova, like all across the world. And that's exciting to me to find talent in different places.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that, because it's kind of a little bit of a revolution in terms of how companies can deliver the embedded recruiter solution. Because back in the before times, you would have had to have put someone on site. That was what the customer would demand, right? They would say, hey, I'm paying this money for you. I need to see this person line of sight. COVID comes in, suddenly you can't do this. And actually, they don't want you there. It's like, I don't want you bringing COVID into the office. Stay where you're on, deliver your embedded solution in a digital way. And that suddenly that opens up the global market, doesn't it? Because as you so correctly identify, so many people have the skill set and the talent potential to do extremely well in this industry, but they've previously been locked out for basically logistical reasons. And also, a lot of the countries I think you've mentioned are outside of, the EU, outside of the Schengen area. So there was never an opportunity really to smoothly relocate. They were oftentimes locked into those countries. Going with the global approach, you've got the opportunity to tap those resources and really get some talented people that can grow with you as a business. By the way, I've been to Skopje way back when. Bizarrely enough, I have been to Strumica. I don't know whether you've been there before.
Other than Leeds to Skopje, I was checking out the flights the other day, Wizz Air from Luton at like 4 a.m. or something like that. But it's most definitely in our plans. And, you know, we've just been blown away by the talent in the team there. We actually met quite a few of them. We did an offsite in Lisbon. So we took the whole, well, we had 44 of the team who came out to Lisbon. I would recommend that as a place for an offsite. Yes, it's sunny, beautiful, the rest of it. It's also good value versus a lot of other European cities. And it was amazing. It was the first time that a lot of our team had actually met in person, certainly over the last 2 years. So it was an amazing moment, and we will keep doing these. We're not too sure on the next location, but it'll be somewhere hot, I think.
I was gonna say I think this may in fact be also a future pattern as to how organizations that are remote first start operating, where there's an annual AGM, it's a big party, it's a multi-day commitment, but it's a way where people can really deepen relationships that they have built in a digital sense, have some great learning, great exchanges, and then move on from there. I think that's pretty much an established pattern by companies like Automatic and Basecamp, who've traditionally, pre-COVID, been remote first. And they've always had this AGM type style of thing to do. So that is fascinating. We actually have a friend from Skopje, Daniel. Thank you very much for saying hello. Wonderful country that you're in. Let's talk about sort of the moment when candidate became a thing. You were watching this recruitment happening. That's all well and good. Most people watch it and complain about it and just get on with their day. So, but when did the penny drop for you? You said, you know what, I'm doing this. I'm setting this thing up.
Well, it's a funny story. So we started off, and the initial plan was to actually build a platform, and we did successfully build a platform. So we actually acquired a company which was called Rise High. And that's how I met Jason Wong, who I think you know is the co-founder. We raised just shy of £1 million, and we went on this journey to try and build a platform really focused around commercial roles in the UK. So sales and marketing were the roles that we started off with. The reality, as we both know, is that it's one thing to build a platform. The hard part is attracting really quality candidates and doing that at a volume where you basically need to be spending about £100,000 a month is what we worked out on marketing, just to have this flow or to have a model where you've got a flow of candidates. So at the same time, we started...
Let me just interject on this note. By the way, if anybody is like setting up a marketplace in this way, Alex and I have both tried this. And I remember, having a conversation with the founder maybe last month, and she was doing this. And I said, listen, don't like, just don't.
He's come and speak to us, and we just gave you 3 years.
Yeah, just don't. The reason why is because you just need to spend a consistent huge amount of some money acquiring new candidates all the time, because it doesn't matter. The candidates basically are not permanent in your system, because if they don't get a job, they check out, that they're annoyed at your platform and they think it's useless and they'll bail. If they do get a job, then they're off the platform as well. So, you know, they're no longer active. So you have to keep shoveling these candidates in. And if in the history of recruitment marketplaces, where it's highly automated, the vision initially was to highly automate everything. None of them, I think, have been particularly successful in that way. The ones that have succeeded have actually basically got a lot of recruiters in to help make the connections between candidates and essentially become very recruitment agency like. So, I think the dream of complete, reduced human touch, automated matching, not happening. Anyway, that's my interjection. Go ahead, Alex.
No, I think it's a very important point. And there are platforms that are working. I mean, I just think of one, so Tempo is working, but you know, they have had significant investment, typically five, I'm a kind of 10 million plus. the whole background of the Hired.com, who imploded with over 100 million, that made it very hard for us to raise. And that basically all happened at the same time. So you had this situation where the VCs saw Hired.com implode with 100 plus million, and they, you know, they just marked off. Recruitment platforms were marked off. Now, there are some newer models now that I think are really interesting, but the reality is that we had to shift into a different model. So we were building a platform, but we had an agency side to our business, and then we had the embedded side. The agency side, we finished that about 12 months ago, one of the best days of my life. And just to clarify, I'm only saying that just because it was incredibly stressful, and I really respect anyone who is scaling on the agency side, because that I really found to be one of the most challenging things. Just the intensity of and the pressure of having to like deliver for that was something. And we had, I think we got it up to about 9 seats on that side. The embedded side, we had always run alongside it, and just sort of organically we started to notice it was just a really nice relationship with the clients, and the candidates seemed to trust us more because we were actually sitting and part of that company. So it was sort of something that we were moving towards. We knew there were other competitors who were building extremely quickly, and we were kind of following them, but that wasn't why we built Candidate. So it was actually May of last year, our board sat me down and said, look, that, you know, the embedded part of the business is working and it's making money. You should focus on that. And I was like, absolutely not. And I'm certainly not taking your advice. took me about a month, and I battled with them really, really hard. And it's the best thing that we've ever done. I think the interesting thing is when you just focus on one part of the business, we realized that we were split across actually three parts. And now I look back on it, of course, you know, we were always under pressure because we were trying to do so many different things. What's interesting now is just focusing on the embedded side, we're really going very, very deep into process, into sourcing, into how to scale this model. And the results are better. The team is happier. We've gone from 25 up to 91 people in the last 12 months. And so you could argue we've only actually been doing this for a year, where we've totally focused on this model, and we're just shy of 100 people. It's changed a lot, because I think, you know, when we were just below 50 people, I was doing everything. And that is, you know, anyone who's running a seed or series A where you're across everything, it really takes its toll. It's challenging. Now we've just have you come across Traction
as a product?
It's a book called Traction. It's like an alternative to kind of OKRs.
Mm-hmm. I haven't actually heard of it.
Yeah, it's Ben Fletcher at the Fast Growth Icons, he put me onto it. We spoke to about 3 or 4 founders who'd actually stopped using OKRs and moved to Traction. It's a book. It's by a guy called Gino in the States. And I'm always a bit wary, like a US book on goal setting methodology just screams bullshit to me.
Sorry to our US viewers. It's like, okay.
No, sorry, I didn't mean it like that. I just meant like that there are some books like that where it's written for the corporate. It's written for the corporate world. And I thought, oh, how's this going to apply to scale up or startup world? And it's just been amazing. It simplifies a lot of people you speak to about OKRs. They spend their whole time updating the spreadsheet rather than actually doing what the OKR is intended or the goal is intended for that quarter. It's a much more transparent and simplified way of trying to build a company. And it has just been a breath of fresh air. One weekly meeting. There's a very certain style they like to do that meeting in. And it's just, I really would suggest it for any industry, any founder. You will feel your stress levels dropping because you're not managing everything through touch and feel and, you know, all the rest of it. You're just looking at the results, at the scorecard, essentially.
That's really interesting. So, and I'm thankful to hear there's alternatives to OKR, because I think it can become tyrannical, you know.
When, that was my experience.
Yeah, you just feel like constantly like a slave to this beast that you've externalized, because you know the beast is actually the CEO's instructions, but you've externalized it into a set of these goals that everyone's working towards, and that becomes its own thing. It's almost like it's like for some reason I think it's like Venom, you know, the Spider-Man thing. It's like,
I don't. I'll go with it.
It's an external thing that suddenly becomes monstrous, and you know you're battling that as much as battling everything else. So I'm pleased to hear there's other things. Traction is the book. If anyone's read this, by the way, I'd love to hear your thoughts on it, and whether this may be a way to basically stay on course, but do so in a less oppressive kind of manner. Okay. You've introduced something that's quite interesting with your relationship with the board, Alex. This is something that I think most CEOs of a certain level or size of business, certainly after fundraising, you're going to have a board of directors. Tell me about how you handle that relationship, because it seems that firstly, they gave you really good advice, but it took a while for you to absorb that. So what do you take away from this? I mean, are you happy that you did take a little while and you were strong in the first instance and you didn't kind of just go with what the board said? Or yeah, are you a little bit frustrated to say, you know what, why did I take a month, you know?
I think, look, I mean, sometimes for the outsider, whether it be a consultant or a board member, sometimes they can't see what you can. And I think as entrepreneurs, sometimes, you know, there's a goal you're trying to get to, or there's somewhere you're trying to get to, and you know the fastest route to get there. And to have someone questioning your methods or rest of it, you know, you're kind of a bit like, look, just let me get on with it. However, and I'm really lucky, and the board we have is a combination of, so one of them, you know, so Ben Fletcher, you know, he's interviewed literally hundreds of scale up founders. So obviously, you know, through repetition, he's a successful entrepreneur himself, but through sort of, I mean, if you hear enough of these stories, you start to spot certain things quite early. So I think he's good. He's also very candid just in his approach. So he calls me out and stuff. I tend to, when I present projections and stuff, I think I always look at, well, this is what it could be, you know? And I think Ben was like, look, well, how about what you think? Just pick it in the middle, maybe, of what it could be. So, that, you know, it's really hard when you're reporting to a board and you're burning money and the product is not necessarily where it should be. I mean, we had a fairly small product team. So Jason was doing the absolute best he could, but you know, we didn't have 25 engineers. So it was very small wins. That was really difficult. Now it's a bit easier because obviously we present a plan and we say how close. If we got close to the plan, if we didn't, we discuss why not. So it tends to be, I think now I have a much better relationship with the board. In the past, I've always treated them as the enemy, to be frank. They were like, you know, they're the guardians. I'll share with them a little bit, but actually we're doing this plan. I think now I've just realized through experience maybe that you just got to be straight with them. And even if it's not good news, they better to know what exactly is going on.
That's a really interesting insight. And thank you for sharing that bit of vulnerability, Alex, because I do think a lot of entrepreneurs do feel that the board is there just to, you know, you do the meeting just to get through it. And you know, sure. just keep them happy and then just get on with the real work of the business. And it seems to me that's a little bit like, that's kind of exhausting, isn't it? Because you're actually expending effort and energy, away from the business in order to placate, this semi-attached, semi-remote part of the business. Whereas in fact, what you want to do is to have a much more, team-based approach where they're looking in the same direction as you are and having the same data and what have you. Have you changed anything in terms of your processes with this kind of shift in mindset, or has it generally been sufficient to have the mindset shift? I'm thinking, has there been any increase of transparency? Is one of the ways in which you could do it, you know, access to the data straight away rather than do it in reports? Have you thought about any of that?
No, we haven't done that. I think certainly using Traction, at least we've got a template now. So, you know, they really understand. So Traction uses this word, which is called ROCs, which is essentially what are your goals? Every person has your ROCs for that quarter. So we discuss that and we share that with the board up front. They then have actual individual kind of visibility on, okay, your what were the ROCs for your VP of people, the rest of it. So they understand what those goals are. And it just gives them, I think, more kind of visibility how you're trying to run that quarter. The other thing I'd recommend is that sometimes if you actually explain what the problems are, they might help you solve them. I know
sounds obvious, but this is well worth repeating because
it really is. And because I came from that mentality, I was like, I just want to present this kind of perfect veneer of, oh, we, you know, this is what's happening, rest of it. And then everything behind the scenes, I was like, oh, well, you know, but now actually, if you present the problems first, you say, look, we could really do with your help on, or we're really trying to hire this. In the US, angel investors are very, very active. That's one of the ways that they can differentiate themselves by talking about their network and rest of it. So a lot of entrepreneurs in the States, or it's global, but especially in the States, they really up what they can bring to the business because there's a lot of money around in startups, in tech. They have to prove themselves as kind of angel investors, which is, I think that is starting to happen here, but I've certainly seen it more in the States.
Yep. Very, very interesting. And you know what? I think this issue, I love the idea of presenting the problems first. I actually think this would be a great way to default to doing most reports, wouldn't it? I was just thinking, like, even at the like governmental level, you know, when you've got Rishi Sunak stepping up and giving his speech, Boris Johnson or whatever it is stepping up, and it's, you can just see it's just spinning everything. You can't trust a single word they're saying because they're just like hoping you go away, essentially, from additional scrutiny. Like, wouldn't it be refreshing, folks, if people just said, look, we're going to tell you the problems up front, then we're going to talk about the wins that we've had over the last 3 months or so. I think that would really take away this sense that you need to create this illusory type of vision, which is really just a shield from scrutiny. No business, no endeavor worth doing is without problems, right? I mean, that's why there's a business. That's why you're doing stuff, because there are problems to be solved. So, you know, I think that could be a really useful thing. You know, if we could all do that industry-wide, boom, I think meetings and reports get better straight away.
It's got a name now, hasn't it? So when you build your startup publicly, it's got a certain name, which is not coming to me now. But, you know, I think the tools like Notion and any sort of productivity tool where people are just really open. I mean, I'm amazed how much data people share about revenues and things like that. That's sometimes, I mean, shit, if I think about us when we were building the platform, if we'd been open over this, would it have helped us? Yeah, possibly. I think I would have just been so scared of what people thought because we were figuring so much stuff out behind the scenes.
Yeah. I totally get what you're saying because I try to operate as much as I can openly with Recruiting Brain Food. But I haven't shared all of the data that I could share. I look at my financial accounts. I could publish that. But half of me feels like, should I? Because it's like, there is some barrier there to say that building public, thank you. But I think that ultimately it's a fine line. You've got to think about what is what the people want to see. It's not necessarily everything. What is it that's important to the observer or whoever it is that might take an interest in it? If you're a business, then it probably is things like growth, business wins, business losses, things like that. Why not? You know, I mean, we have the data in there, and probably People won't judge you overly harshly on it. Having said that, caveat, they may. And it may be one of those where it almost becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, where if your numbers are bad for whatever reason, that scares off a bunch of people, and then your numbers get worse, then that's, it scares off more people, and it just drives down. And then the opposite might also happen, where you decide to go public publicly in when the time's good, and that attracts like more people. So there is an element where your publicity of it might actually have might contribute to the performance. So you gotta think about it and take care of your business is the top priority as well. Okay, so let's talk about your kind of lessons in running this business now, Alex. You've grown it from to nearly 100 people. If you could kind of give yourself advice, 6 years or so ago when you started it, what are the top three things you would recommend to yourself?
I think it's trying to manage yourself as a founder or manage your emotions is the biggest challenge that's happening, because you're always going to look on social media or speak to someone and think, oh, shit, they're doing that, or they've just launched this piece of research. And, you know, you can quite easily start drifting your eyes of, gosh, everything is better than my business. So I think you just got to focus on the parts that you can control. And I think like there's just one sentence that I keep repeating, especially through the bad time, is it's never as bad as you think, and it's never as good as you think. And I think if founders can just keep that in mind, you know, when you're fundraising, when you do something good, you know, celebrate the small wins. If something screws up, own it publicly, apologize, move on, you know, because I just think it's so easy to live your life just by comparing. We all have competitors, you know, no doubt there's going to be one competitor that has more funding or is getting more publicity and the rest of it. Just stick to what you can control and keep smiling, because, you know, there's going to be a lot of things that are going to try and knock you off the course, but just keep smart, try and enjoy the process. I think on previous businesses, I was so intent on the outcome, I didn't even enjoy the small moments, because I just thought, right, if I enjoy the small moments, I'm taking my eye off the ball. You know, there is so much luck with actually selling a business. You might think that it was all you and you did it perfectly, the rest of it. The reality is that if you sell a business, it's a miracle. It's like producing a movie. If you actually produce a movie, actually get 200 people on a film set and actually get it to the cinema, that's a miracle. I think with a business, you are slightly more in control of it rather than a studio. But you just got to remember that there's an element of luck and timing, and the exit, you know, may happen, may not happen. And just try and enjoy it as much as you can, because there are tough moments, no doubt.
You know what? That's really great advice. I love this, Alex, particularly with the... you know, the couple of points you mentioned, I think super interesting. Number one, self-management, like emotional regulation. That's important for two reasons, I think. Number one, for your own longevity as a leader of a business. Like, you have to avoid burnout, actually. You know, if you're a CEO of a business, you are actually a key asset, maybe the main asset for the company. You can't burn that asset to the ground by, you know, not by failing to emotionally regulate. It's like having a Ferrari in the garage and like driving it and driving it into, you know, to pull a tractor or something. No, it's you've got to take care of it. So we
need caveat, to... as you said, caveat. I am work in process, because if not, my team would be like, oh yeah, you know.
yeah. We could all do this better, right? I kind of advising myself as much, even though I don't run a business with people in it, I do run a company. And totally, there's times when I'm thinking, crikey, I'm like totally getting slammed here. But emotional regulation, physical fitness, all that stuff, it needs to be a part of the game plan. If you're not doing it, you need to diarize it, itemize it, and make sure it's in there, because it's a thing to do. The second thing that you mentioned was really interesting, was just the idea of enjoying the process. So outcome focus is obviously something that entrepreneurs tend to be. And in fact, you'll find delivery centered people, outcome-based people, they know how to try and get it through to the end, get things done, so to speak. But you have to enjoy the flow, because it's not like the life cycle of the business. The journey itself is not like three weeks. You know, you might be there at least 3 years, probably six, maybe more. That is the reality of building a business. So you can't sacrifice 6 years of your life, 10 years of your life in the hope of some sort of outcome, because that's your life. You need to enjoy the way to do it, you know?
Yeah. And you speak to, it's actually speaking to entrepreneurs who got to the exit. And, you know, you speak to a couple who said, oh, I got to the exit, but then I was so burnt out, I couldn't even enjoy it for 2 or 3 years. And then you start scratching your head thinking, all right, well, then what was the point? You know, and I have most definitely gone through burnouts in my career. I've been doing this for 20 odd years as a founder. You do get to burnout. It just happens. The problem is that after each burnout, it becomes, you know, it's even more, you have to be even more careful about how you manage yourself. So I think I'm definitely getting there.
you keep saying things that are really fascinating, Alex. So multiple burnout recovery. So I've always considered burnout to be like a definitive status. Like, you're burnt out, you're done, like it's over. But you're saying no, you can burn out and actually recover and go at it again. So tell me a little bit about this.
Yeah, well, I think there's a medical side to it. It depends, you know, what I mean, burnout is a catch-all expression. It could be physical, it could be mental, things like that. So I think there are degrees of it for sure. I think if you're smart, you recognize it early and then you seek help, or the first thing is you just have to slow everything down. So that, you know, you could apply this to any mental health condition, you know, in the workplace. But certainly for me, I just had to take time out. It's never a good time. It's always when you've just closed funding, or funding is the one moment where I just think it's so unfair on most founders, because you're running a business and then you've suddenly got this kind of new job. And for some reason, investors don't seem to understand that. They're always just asking you for more and more things. So I think funding for me is the one time where any founder should just say, right, I've got two jobs now. And either find someone to run the company or find someone who can help you with that funding process. I'm surprised there isn't a sort of like an embedded funding COO who just comes in and manages that process through Series A, and I guess you'd call that a CFO. I think there is a business there for someone. So sorry,
I mean,
off the point there, but
no. The just as a segue, but really important segue, is that the demands that traditional VCs and investors make to founders have been well known to be excessive. And oftentimes with no guarantee of outcome, of course. So you might end up doing loads and loads and loads of work, but then getting no output from it at all. And at the same time, you've neglected your business because you've gone and pitched for this funding, which is why, was it Tiger Global? Is the revolutionary sort of investment arm? Is it like literally written more deals than any business, like by an order of magnitude? And the way they do it, I think they give a 3-day promise or something. They'll simply say, yo.
Yeah, I think some of the investors now are being, it's a much easier process. The only way that I've done it in the past with kind of angels and VCs, and this is going to sound absolutely ridiculous, was I would always ask them out for a drink, as in like an alcoholic drink. If they just had one, hear me out. If they just had one drink and left, I'd be like, not sure. If they had two drinks, I'd be like, okay, fine. If they stuck around and we could really get into it, and I could sort of, I'm not saying all my investors are alcoholics, but I needed to understand who the person was behind just the investment. And that was the only way that I could do it, was actually just kind of sitting with them. Alcohol helps just as a lubricant. Sometimes people give away what they really think. But that was the only like method that I found to actually see it. The problem in a boardroom is that, you know, it's very hard to actually read them. They will just keep asking for more information. And they never really, investors are famous for not really telling you what's really going on or why they actually didn't invest in the business. So
yeah, and there's a lot of performance as well there, isn't it? Like both sides are performing when you're pitching to the thing. They're performing because they're, you know, over, it's almost like the Simon Cowell thing. You know, they have to present an image. Present an image not only to themselves, but to the audience of other investors that are there. You know, everyone's like doing this ritual and it's like,
Twitter obviously too sometimes it's right. Ludicrous really, but
right, it's a show. So anyway, revolutions are happening. There's different ways to get investment, different ways to get funding. Hopefully we can find other ways to, you know, get capital investment to companies that, you know, have a shot at making it, and not put too much pressure onto those businesses that you know, don't have the slack. And, you know, when you're starting up and you're running a proper business, you shouldn't have any slack, you know, you should already be working like maxed out. Absolutely. So, you know, getting the additional funding in is going to be just another thing that you have to do. Moving towards future focus, Alex, where are Candidate now and what can we expect from you and your team for the rest of 2022 and beyond?
So I think, yeah, so we're moving out to the US. We've always had clients in the US, but I just came back from a trip, actually. I was in Nashville and New Orleans, which amazing. Is two locations that we are looking at for a potential office.
Please meet why Dolly there? Parton if she's there. get her to invest.
So many amazing things about both of those cities. But I think for me, so New York, I used to live in. I was there for 9 years. San Fran, we all know the pluses and the minuses about starting a company there. Austin, everyone has flooded there. So I think for me, I was looking for somewhere a bit different. Prices are better. There's amazing talent in both of those cities. I think anyone starting a US office should be, you know, it's a slightly different thought to not going for the obvious places and just going for where there's talent. So the move into the US is a really big, that's going to happen from July onwards. We're going to carry on growing. Sourcing team, I hope, is going to be close to 100 by the end of the year. So we're just going to carry on growing. I hope we can grow steadily and thoughtfully. Always a thought on our team culture. We've fought very hard to keep this culture. As teams grow, we all know there's a massive danger, especially over that 100 mark. You start to see companies change. And you have to be really intentional about that culture piece. It's so easy to say, much harder to do.
Do you know what? That 100 is not just a casual number, because I think it is close to the Dunbar number, which is the point at which the CEO is not able to personally know every person in the business. So that is a big change of the business, in other words. So 50 and under for sure, the CEO first name to everyone in the business, you would imagine. And then as you keep going closer to 150, which is I think the maximum number of people that you can kind of have a decent intimate relationship with, you will have to jettison it, and you'll start encountering people in this metaphorical office that we have that you just don't know who they are. But they're employees of yours. So that in itself is a big cultural milestone for businesses. And as you say, Alex, this is where you need to have some intent and some understanding of as this phase shift, because you need to do different things in order to, you know, keep the culture coherent.
It's absolutely vital. I think for every successful company, there are very few companies I've come across who've scaled really quickly where there's not something about the culture which is unique. It doesn't have to be, oh, it was amazing, the rest of it, but there was something about the culture that you could just walk in and say, there's something they're doing differently. They might express it in, oh, we do this ritual or we do this and all the rest of it. But when you spend time there, and we spend time inside a lot of organizations, and you start to pick up all the different types and kind of nuances of culture that exist. This is fascinating to me.
Yeah. And by the way, folks, culture is the stuff that isn't written down. It is the nuances, it's the what is between the lines, how do things really operate. Those are the things that it takes intimacy to get there. It's not something that you can immediately translate. A lot of that information is implicit, and this is where I think the value of the embedded model is, even in a digital embeddedness, because it means that you're interacting and kind of using the same information flows as the end customer. Okay, Alex, the final word to you.
Go ahead. Sorry, one thought there hung very quickly. I know you've got to go. Is this concept of there are certain people who are the glue of the culture, and if you can identify them, they will keep. Not keep your culture, but they are the people who actually keep people together. And I haven't really thought this through, but I do think that at one fine stay, even at 350 people, I can identify the one person who was the glue. And I think if you can do that, that's absolutely amazing.
On that note, we have to spend just a bit more time on it, because that person who, or it could be several people, they are like the cultural nodes in that company. And that's got zero relationship often with the official position in the org structure. It's nothing to do with, but it's where the real information flows. I remember this really well in my first company that I worked in when I first joined recruiting. There was obviously all kinds of heads of and this, that, and the other. Most important person in that company, a lady called Jane Rawdon. She was like the office manager or something. But she like knew everybody. She knew all the conversations. She could get things done. You know, if you needed a back channel, go to Jane. She'd fix it. And I was thinking, you know what? Whatever this woman's getting paid is not enough. She needs to be paid more, because she's absolutely critical to this, how this social organization functions. By the way, we have to leave it here, but you can actually track this with data. If you use organizational network analysis, you could probably figure out where information flows and what happens when someone emails something or a message. Does that person then trigger events if they say something compared to another person? I think you can probably...
Is there a tool for that?
There is. It's super expensive. It's like enterprise only, because it harvests huge amounts of data. But I'm really excited about the category of ONA, because it's there to try and identify exactly these implicit key players that you don't know who they are. Like they're often, their true value is not actually their official functional job. Their true value is all of the cultural information ferrying that they're doing, which is off their brief, but they have this essential almost like a hidden part of the nervous system of the business. And yeah, we need to know who they are, identify.
Really, this is a plug-in into Slack. If you plug it in, if you get the whole team to plug it into Slack, Gmail, and a couple of other tools, surely someone is going to have a SaaS product, $19 per user per month, where you can identify who the glue is, who should get, you know, who should get that promotion or who should get that extra pay for actually holding the whole company together.
That product does actually exist, but it's still at the enterprise pricing model. So it's no means at the 19, whatever. It's like at the hundreds of thousands, as I understand. We're just waiting for it to get to the consumerization of it. But I think you're absolutely right. You simply can track the digital comms and figure out what happens. So for instance, let's say you have a video meeting. Oh, you have a video meeting with Hung, and guess what? Nothing ever happens at the end of it. It's like there's a burst of negative sentiment email after every meeting with Hung. Nothing happens. But then you have a meeting with Alex, and actually there's loads of positive sentiment messaging, and then suddenly events get booked and shit starts going on and stuff like that. Okay, Alex is the person you need to keep. Hung, you need to get rid of. So this type of stuff, you know, I think we need to have it. It's fascinating space to be in.
All right, Alex. We'll keep the Rocket Internet, and they'll just copy the enterprise one.
Well, I think we need a Rocket Internet type business to do it, you know. But there we go. Okay, final thing, Alex. You're a busy man. What busy CEOing things are you going to do after this call?
I'm going to go boxing. You're a boxer, aren't you?
What? No, have you seen this face? It could not sustain a punch. Although I do back myself, you know, in my weight class, I have to say.
I had this concept that you were a boxer.
No, mate. I'd love to give it a shot. I mean, I've done some boxing training. I think I can throw a punch, but I can't take one.
I've always thought of this. I don't know why. I think Jason told me you're a boxer. I think he may have got that wrong. I always had fast feet, fast mind. I sort of had you in the gym, and
I may have lied to Jason at some point. So I don't want to put it on him.
You have been caught, hung.
Yeah. Well, listen, enjoy your boxing. I want to hear more about this because I think it's a great sport. Obviously, take care and all the rest of it. But yeah, go out and take out some of your frustrations in boxing. Alex Van Claveren, CEO of Candidate, thank you very much for joining us on Founders Focus today.
Super. Thank you so much, Hung.
Wasn't that great, everybody? Really great to speak to Alex. He's always such an enthusiastic, friendly, and insightful guy. I just didn't know half of his biography there. So interesting to hear his perspectives, and I think so much more to learn. Make sure you follow Alex on LinkedIn, by the way, if you aren't already doing so. And of course, if you're hiring for or you need some sort of support in the recruiting side, then check out Candidate. They're a business that can help you scale up your team. Okay, we are back later this Friday, folks. We're going to be talking programmatic job advertising. Nobody knows about this. So we have Robin Stander of Appcast giving us a recruiting sort of job advertising, programmatic job advertising tutorial 101 for dummies. So if you don't know anything about this, you need to know. And by the way, folks, I think you do. Tune in to Brainfuel Live on Friday. Follow the channel if you want to get notified on that. Otherwise, we will see you on Friday. Thank you for watching.